Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Retro Computing Roundtable, show number 34. That's a lot of shows. Recorded Sunday, September 16th, 2012.
This is one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz?
Yay! I'm watching the script.
Your script? I ignore your script.
I'm watching write something that script.
I ignore it. File hosting. I can do it from memory. File hosting for the show is sponsored by CyberEars. If you're looking for a host for your podcast or audio files, then CyberEars is something you should check out. Go to CyberEars.com for all the details. So, hello everyone. I'm Carrington, and I'm sitting in the swivel chair of power. And that means
nice.
I get to play host for this episode of the RCR, and it also means we'll have lots of Apple II talk and very few pants. And speaking of the homeless, I'm joined today by a pair of wandering retro computists of no fixed address. So join me in welcoming David, It Ain't Easy Being Greelish, and the sixth Ninja Turtle Evans.
Wow.
How you doing, guys?
Hello.
What's up?
I was going to make you the fifth Ninja Turtle, but I decided to be more mysterious and go for six.
Yeah, that's good. I do tend to hide in my shell when I need to.
Oh.
They probably had an honorary one, haven't they? Fifth, somewhere along the line.
Perhaps.
I'll have to have an artistic name, though. Maybe Picasso. I can be Picasso, the sixth Ninja Turtle.
And actually, I was flipping channels the other day.
I don't think that works. Now.
They apparently have a new Ninja Turtle show on. Where it's like
CGI. Don't even talk about it.
Well, what color should my headband be? Maybe it should be plaid.
It looked okay. I mean, the turtles looked okay. I didn't watch
Paisley.
It,
I'm Paisley Turtle.
I'm going to ignore both of you through this whole episode. That's what I've decided.
I think you're a wise man.
Okay, retro computers. You've heard of them. You love them. David, I want you to kick us off. Kick us off the air completely with this first bit of news. Something about the last call for something about a V. What is it?
Oh, you're at the bottom here.
I'm at the bottom? I'm at the top.
Oh, I shifted around the items.
Oh.
That's okay.
Don't confuse the host.
Talk about it.
Well, basically, so it's last call for the VCFMW, which is the Vintage Computer Festival Midwest. Last call meaning, you know, you're not going to hear from us about it anymore because it is next weekend. So Saturday and Sunday, the 22nd, 23rd, it's in the Chicago area in Lombard, Illinois. And it's a good show, and it's 2 days. And it's the VCFMW as well as the, I know we've talked about it before, the Emergency Commodore, I'm looking for it, Anybody? The Emergency Commodore.
Something.
Chicagoland. Yeah. Emergency Chicagoland Commodore.
Convention.
Yeah, that would be the other seat. Yeah.
So I wanted to mention it again. It's worth going to. You know, it's worth driving sometime or flying to if you've ever been. So go.
I just wish I could drag my feet just a couple days because I'm actually going to be in Chicago Tuesday through Thursday of this
time.
But I can't hold out
through Saturday.
I can't hold out through Saturday. Darn it!
Couldn't shift it like Wednesday through Friday, or
no, I can't. These are business meetings.
That's really too bad.
I'd have to shift everybody else, which I could tell them I want to do that for a Commodore thing. Maybe they'd go for it.
I think they would not. It is too bad though because I'd like one of us to eventually go to this thing because it seems to be run by people with real senses of humor. The whole, you know, annual last version. Currently it's saying that the Bureau of Circuitry and Electronics Relays of the Emergency Chicagoland Commodore Convention announces year 7 of our inspiring and humane 5-year plan.
Yeah, I like that.
Love it.
I just dig these guys. Earl, we should force you to go. You have to go. You don't have
but
a choice.
I went last year.
I wish I could.
Guys, remember I went last year.
I do remember that.
I
don't remember that.
Yeah, when
prove it.
Earl was at the Portland Game Show, right, Earl?
Yeah, and no. That's right. We had dueling remotes.
Yeah, live feeds
that
or whatever
day.
You want.
That was awesome. I was at the Portland Retro Gaming Expo, which is also coming right up.
Oh yeah, when is that?
2 weekends from today, I think. Yeah, I think so. 29th and the 30th. And we talked about it last time. There's a link up in the show notes there if people are interested. I hope they're interested.
Okay.
It's a great show.
They're not interested.
They are. They love retro gaming.
I love retro gaming.
Especially in Portland. We really love it.
I'm sure the event will go well. I've got a soft spot for this event that I've never been to it. So just
the Chicago
just
one, yeah.
Draws me to this thing. So, Earl.
Yes.
Earl the Pearl. URL, Earl.
Earl the Pearl. That's good. I've never heard that before.
X11 has turned 25.
It has. all of its wondrous windows and buttons and little things have turned 25. So have you guys used Unix machines or other such that have X11, the
sure,
X-Windows system?
I have used it on the Mac previously.
Yeah, and obviously if you've used Linux to any extent, you've
I've
used
seen
the
it.
System. But I mean, back in the day, like Solaris boxes, or actually they'll probably get me in trouble, Solaris, I think they pronounce it, HPUX, IBM stuff, you know, X11 was all over the place. I used it 20 years ago when I was working for a router company. We had Sun boxes, the good old Spark Station 10s that ran it, and doggone, pretty impressive systems. So I have we were mentioning SoftSpot in our hearts, and I have one of those for the X11 system. So just wanted to mention it's 25, and we've got a link to an article that talks about its genesis and how it came about. One of the things I thought was most entertaining was back then, if you wanted to order it, you had to get it on 9-track, real, you know, the old computing tapes. So that was pretty cool. That kind of shows its age. And it's held up pretty well. You know, we're still using it today. So go X11.
I remember seeing it on some early, you know, like PowerPC Macs, and then on some equipment at NASA. I worked at NASA Langley in Virginia. I just remember in passing seeing it. They used it quite a bit, at least early on, in like 2000 when I started there.
Nice sophistication, too, the client-server nature of it, where, you know, if you're a client, you're really kind of a server. It's weird, because the server is interpreted as the thing that's displaying the desktop, and the client is the application that is then creating a window and drawing on it from that server. So it's kind of, the nomenclature is backwards, and it has a lot of very sophisticated technologies, like its management of fonts and its management of remote windows like that. You know, really cool. I think that's probably one of the reasons why it's held up as well as it has. So I just wanted to throw that out there, and people can read the article that we've got linked up in the show notes over on foronix.com.
Happy birthday, X11.
Yep. It's 25, but like I said, doesn't look a day over 20.
It does. Okay, so speaking of over 20, well over 20, $1,505 over 20, an Apple One replica sold on eBay. I think, David, you had shouted out about this on Twitter. I had been following the auction before that as well, and sort of reading about the bit of controversy over this particular model. It seems...
I didn't read any of the controversy, so I'm interested to hear it.
I'll tell you, but I'll generate. I'm stirring this pot. So this seems to have been the Newton One. Have you guys heard of that that model of Apple One replicas?
No, I see some of the other people you mentioned in the show notes, and I've heard of those. But,
yeah,
I
was aware of the Mimeo, and really that's it. And, of course, the Vince Briel's replica one, which is a different sort of thing. So
All
this was new to me. I really didn't know that there was this kind of field of Apple One replicas. I sort of had heard of the Mimeo, but didn't really know what it was, and I was well aware of the replica one, because Vince Briel is awesome and comes to Kansas Fest, and I've seen them and have sort of considered purchasing one myself as well, and he's got that I Can't Solder sale on right now, so you can save $50 and get an assembled kit, though I'd rather make one. So stuff like that. I was much more aware of the replica ones. So when I saw this eBay auction for what I had presumed was a replica one, I was really surprised that when I first looked at it, it was going for $500 or something. And I thought, well, isn't the replica one only $200 new? Like if you get it assembled, and like $150 if you get it as a kit, like why would somebody buy one of these for $500? And so I watched the auction, and then it got to be like $600, $700, it passed $1,000. It's like, what is going on? So I tried to figure out, why was this replica one going for so much money? Then it turned out it wasn't a replica one. It was something else. And I guess there's this whole other culture, I guess, of making Apple One replicas with vintage parts. So the replica one, it remakes the Apple One, but does it using more modern technology.
Yeah, it's what I would call a work-alike versus
exactly,
a reproduction.
Yeah. So there was Mike Willigal's Mimeo is the only one I had heard of separate from the replica one, but I never really knew what the difference was. And the Mimeo is more, you know, trying to actually recreate the Apple One, like with as close as possible to what you would have purchased back in the day. So it's not just a workalike, it's, you know, make one that's pretty much indistinguishable. Even right on the board, it says Apple Computer, like it's printed the same, all of that. So this one on eBay turns out to be a Newton one, not the Mimeo. And I also found another model of these called the Optronix by Steve Gallaby. And I was really not aware of the differences between these things. And I guess there was a bit of controversy a few months ago when the Newton one was announced. And so I'll put a link in the show notes over at applefritter.com. There's a thread sort of discussing it when somebody came across the Newton one on on YouTube and talking about it, and then they said, well, this looks like just a ripoff of the Mimeo. And then people are saying, well, what do you mean it's ripping off the Mimeo? Because the Mimeo is sort of ripping off the Apple One. What's the difference? But the Mimeo, I guess, was made from looking at the original Apple One and trying to figure out, like, there's traces on the board that you can't see because they're below chips and stuff. And if you don't have an Apple One, you don't know how the trace was done. So we had to sort of figure it out. And people were looking at this Newton one saying the, you know, hidden traces seem to follow exactly what the Mimeo did. So is this somebody who just bought a Mimeo and then they've ripped it off to make their own Apple One? And then the guy that made the Newton one got on the board and said, no, I'm not. Like, we had to guess, and you can look at how my traces go differently here. And then once you go down that rabbit hole, it turns out there's a lot of people who know a lot of stuff about this and will look at the traces on a board. And I never knew to look for something like that, like to see like whether it turns 90 degrees, whether it's rounded, and that kind of stuff. And all the little details that you can look at that are really minute to tell the difference between a Mimeo and an Apple One and a Newton One. And it struck me as an interesting sort of topic that maybe in the future somebody would have to be able to look at, like, an Apple One and be able to tell, is that really an Apple One or not? And how do you tell that from a Mimeo? And it's in these tiny little details of looking at particular traces that go higher or lower or the thickness of the trace and that kind of stuff. And it was just interesting because I've never looked at vintage computers as art the way that you'd look at a painting to tell, is it legitimate or is it a knockoff? And it was interesting that there is that same thing when it comes to computer technology, and it just had never occurred to me.
And there's enough value in this one, you know, where it's driving a small market that might grow.
Sure. Well, it's interesting too because I started looking at the history of the sale of these things. So back in like 2008 or so, Mimeos would go on eBay for mid 300s, you know, $300, $350, that kind of stuff.
I think
and
without parts, though,
four years later. Well, no, that was a full Mimeo.
Really?
You could get yourself one, and 4 years ago, everyone said, like, oh my God, it's hundreds of dollars. But of course, that was before
the crazy auctions,
right before
a
bunch of the auctions came out and stuff. And it's interesting how now it's, you know, five times more just for these kits and how this whole market has exploded in value.
It is fascinating, and they are very cool too. There's one of the fellows in the Seattle group that I go to from time to time that actually created one of these. I have to admit, I don't know which particular flavor that he based his work off of, but he's got a nice display unit under glass. And
I think that's the Mimeo. I was reading about it. I read about the people that have made them.
Yeah, he's gone to an extreme amount of care to go out and find the original chips as opposed to a modern-day version of the chip, that is, chips with the correct date stamp codes and all of that, so that this thing could be as much like an Apple One as is humanly possible. And it's pretty fascinating to look at, and it's very educational, too.
Mm-hmm. I learned a ton just things and looking at PCB traces and how you tell one from the other, the idea that somebody would be aware of those things, the idea of trying to recreate something in the exact original form versus trying to do what Vince Briel has in what like as David said, more of a work-like. Mm-hmm. And just all the it was a whole world of stuff I had no idea about. So I found the whole topic fascinating. So I did want to spend $1,500 on this thing. So yeah. I was not the one who bought this item.
Well, and also the person, so it looks like he had listed it before and didn't get what he wanted. Pretty sure it's the same. Or no, this is the one in Hong Kong. Is it in Hong Kong?
Yes.
Are you guys looking at it?
And the same kit has listed before by the same seller, the Newton one. I think it's Michael Ng.
Right, before he had it for $2,299, nobody went for that.
Right, but he did previously sell one on eBay, I think, for $1,300 and something. So this is higher than previous sale values for the same kit.
I thought it was also fascinating that you get not just the Apple One replica, but also some of the original materials that you mm-hmm. would have received if you purchased an Apple One.
You get like the whole experience.
Exactly, like a box that looks like the box that you would have received.
Right down to, he was talking about the details and looking at how the instruction manuals were bound, that they weren't spiral bound, that they were a different sort of binding to make sure that they bind them the same way. It's just really neat that somebody would go to that length to make the details that accurate.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
I think you get a scraping of DNA from WAS. I mean, you get a whole bunch of stuff.
He gets a better price for it, and I'm not knocking that necessarily. It's very nice. I mean... Yeah.
No, it is.
And he did address the controversy. I shouldn't leave that hanging. Sorry, I should be clear about that. There was that whole idea. Mike Ng went right into that same thread and was talking about it, saying, no, I didn't, and here's the difference between them, and you can look at the two on top of each other and the different decisions that were made in recreating it, and such minor details that a lot of people didn't even people interested didn't spot it and originally thought it was a Mimio knockoff until he looked at, no, you have to look this closely and you'll see the difference and stuff. So, working on a whole different level than I am.
Real quick, too, Carrington, I noticed you have one link in there to Apple Fritter. And,
yes.
Do you know that guy's name from Apple Fritter offhand? I'm trying to think what his name is, but I've met him one time,
Mr.
a lot of years ago.
Mr. Fritter.
Well, I know he published a book about building an Apple One replica. Have you guys ever seen that before, or a reproduction?
No.
No.
Okay. Well, we can move on. I can look that up real quick. See if I can.
Yeah, that'd be great.
We'll wait.
You want to wait?
Okay. Well, the next bit of news is from you. So.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, why don't you do that, and then you could look it up. We'll talk about it. Maybe toward the end.
Oh, you found it already.
It's Tom Owad. Tom Owad. And the name, and I'll put the link in the show notes, so the book is called The Apple One Replica Creation, Back to the Garage. And apparently maybe it has an introduction by the WAS. It has Steve Wozniak's name in there, but it came out in 2005, first edition. Anyway, so I'm not sure what's different about those that were built, or you can only get it used about $33. Okay, but we'll put a link in the show notes.
So are either of you going to go and duplicate the computers of your youth in a bit-by-bit way?
No.
I'm happy with my replica one. But I do have to say, like, as far as a reproduction, well, I guess it's not like, another Vince Briel kit, my Altair Micro. You know, it's not really a reproduction. It's a more functional work-alike, I guess, because it's mini and it's got little switches and all that. And so that's cool. But it's not trying to be a real full-on Altair. It looks exactly like an Altair. So, but I know some people have done that too.
But it's interesting, though. See, think about it. I mean, there's so many different ways to get at the retro computing experience now. You've got, like, at the least accurate way, just using a modern computer and a software replica. And then the most accurate way, go and buy actual vintage stuff. And then there's that weird gray scale between them from work-alikes and look-alikes and all that kind of stuff. It's interesting. I guess different people are going to fall different places along those lines. It seems to me that if I want the retro experience, I probably would want to shell out and get one of these, like get a Mimio, get something that is actually that item as close as possible. I'm never going to afford an actual Apple One. But I think if I wanted the Apple One experience, I probably would go all the way there. I think that knowing about these things would now make me less happy with a replica one. Because I'd see the difference in the power supplies and stuff. Because otherwise, I might as well just be on an emulator. Like, I can get Apple One emulators easy enough.
The same sort of thing happens in a lot of different antique markets. For instance, most 50-year-old cars, they're not going to be absolutely... Well, what am I going for? That's where they're taking an actual old car and, I guess, redoing it so it works. They have to put new parts in that. But actually, there's reproduction Shelby Cobras and reproduction... DeLoreans, I think a company started making it. So, and then there, I think there's reproduction like really classic Victrolas and Coke machines and that kind of stuff. And of course, people take them and they restore them, and then they're not 100% original because they got to put new guts in them and that kind of stuff. But the sort of same sort of thing happens across different antique markets.
And again, I think it has to do with what you're going to do with it. If I got a replica one and I wanted to play with it, I would probably, well, I said replica one, if I got some replica of an Apple One and wanted to actually work with it and do fun stuff with it, then I might tend to go for a replica one because that would be less expensive, and if it broke, it wouldn't be breaking the piggy bank again. You know, going back to what's your purpose for it? If your purpose is to have a museum piece replica that you can look at and go, wow, this was like back in the day,
right,
for both educational and nostalgic purposes, then, yeah, something like the Mimeo might be the way to go. If you're poking around with it and you just want to learn about it at a functional level, then the replica one might be the way to go.
Right. Have you guys been looking at the comments? There's lots of really interesting stuff going on in our comment field.
Oh, cool. How many people do we have, Carrington, since you've got the...
9,000.
9,000. We're up to 9,000.
900 million thousands. But one comment...
There's one of you guys could comment, because I had it up, but I wasn't getting the comments. And then I tried to go over there, and so I don't know how I did it last time where I could look at it, but it wasn't working for me.
And just an interesting comment, but that it seems on the classic computer thread, they really trashed the quality of this particular kit. So it could be something to be aware of if you're looking at purchasing one of these Newton ones. And they're also talking about how Mike, with the Mimeo, it says he really went out of his way to make it close, but he left a few things different just so it couldn't be used to fake a real Apple One. So I thought that was both of those really interesting comments.
I'm just trying to get back over there, but I guess we'll move on.
I thought it was interesting that same comment. I want an Apple III kit with chips that loosen when it gets too hot.
Awesome. Oh, there you go. Now it's working. I got it up here. All right, so I guess we should move along. So the next one is mine.
Dude, who's the host here? You just sit back. Sorry. Swivel chair of power.
Sorry, I'm just... I thought I was holding this up.
I'll say it's time for us to move on. David, will you take the next bit?
I'm so sorry.
He's so power hungry, David.
I know.
What are we going to do?
God.
This is actually just something. So our friend Benj Edwards from the VintageComputing.com, and I want to give him the proper – it's actually called the Vintage Computing and Gaming blog. And so Ben Edwards writes a lot about computer history and such. So he just started a quick little tweet a few days ago on Twitter, and he asked, is the iPad a PC? Tell me what you think. So got a little bit of discussion happened, not a lot. I just thought, you know, hear our discussion. I responded. So basically I said, certainly you don't mean, is it a, you know, IBM compatible? Obviously it's not a personal PC from that standpoint. So, you know, is it a personal computer? And so basically, in a nutshell, my answer was, I mean, obviously, yes, it's a personal computing device, thus a personal computer, but it's not a personal computer in the sense of what a laptop and a desktop is, because it's limited what you can do with it. It's not a full-featured computer as yet. So that was, in a nutshell, that was my answer. What do you guys think? Debate.
Earl?
No opinion?
It goes back to definitions again. I think that's what we're asking here, right?
I just thought it'd be something interesting. I mean, it's not a. I think the hardware is capable. I think it's a limitation of the software. Right. So, and Android's kind of the same way.
So. Well, I think it's going to depend on what generation that you're coming from when you're talking about this.
Right.
I mean, for us, starting in the generation where if you had a computer, obviously you could program it. You could. Put a new operating system on it, you put other things on it, you do whatever you want. The more controlled devices today, are they a computer? They're a computer in the Turing sense of the word,
right.
But are they a computer in the, wow, I can actually compute in whatever way I choose to compute with it sense of the word? And that's a lot more questionable.
Okay.
I think... I easily see how people make the arguments that certain computing devices, like, say, a PlayStation 3, are not computers, even though they're computing devices that play games, they do what a computer does, but they maybe don't have a keyboard or something like that. But when it comes to the iPad, to me, that seems it's definitely a computer. Because I interact with it in the way, although using slightly different input devices, but I do interact with it in the way that I historically always have with computers. So even for an old fogey like me, that passes the test. If I was to go back in time to 1982 and hand a PlayStation 3 and an iPad to my young self and say, young Carrington, look at all that hair you had. Look at these devices. Are either of these computers? without hesitation, I would have said, well, this iPad is clearly a computer. Computer from the future. It's totally awesome. Oh, my gosh, I'm in Star Trek. But it would obviously be a computer.
You wouldn't go, Mom, there's some strange man in my bedroom.
I'd be, oh, him again. I will not invest in that stock, you tell me. Apple will never be worth anything. You're a crazy man. I'm putting it all into Netscape. I think it's silly to even equivocate on it. I think the only people that don't want to call the iPad a computer are people that want to list computer sales volumes and exclude that device. Mm. So I think it's just silly. To me, it's definitely a computer.
So maybe the question is too general, too broad, that maybe a better question would be, is the iPad a laptop or desktop computer replacement? Which I would say no, of course not. What we're doing right now, I can't do it on the iPad. Yeah, I can't edit my... I mean, you can to a certain extent, but I can't... All the things I need to do, I've got to have this computer. An iPad would not solve it for me.
Agreed.
By itself, so... Anyway, okay, just thought it'd be
a couple of really good people chimed in on the forum about this, on the comments. Christopher's saying you'd only consider an iPad a PC after it's been jailbroken because running your own applications is important. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously you can download and run applications on an iPad without being jailbroken, but I think it means like being able to... program it yourself, do whatever you want on it. So I do think that opens up a bit. I think I can, I just can't program it. Well, I mean, I can probably program the iPad without it being jailbroken. So, but I think that's an interesting point. And VintageFlow says if you can write software on the actual device, then it probably can be called a personal computer. So I think that's another pretty decent definition as well. Whereas I don't know right now, like it's difficult to say how you can write software on an iPad. I know there's been a few little scripting things, but it's hard to make most iPad software on the device itself. So I think using that definition...
It's not a self-hosted environment. That's right. A good point.
But most Apple II software, the commercial stuff was often not written at first on an Apple II.
Use cross-compilers and things like that.
Yeah, on a Mac, like the development environment. Stuff
but
like
you
that,
could so. Program on an Apple II if
absolutely.
You want.
Absolutely, and I only ever
the capability.
Did. I mm-hmm. never wrote software for the Apple II on anything except on the Apple II. So there's definitely a difference there. So it's interesting. I know, like you said at the very beginning, Earl, it's all just about definitions and whatever, but I do still find the topic interesting. And the fact that we can discuss it does mean that it's another gray area. I consider the iPad a computer, and yet at the same time, I don't consider the iPhone a computer. So maybe I'm sizist. Who knows? I don't know.
Plus, the fact that we can discuss it civilly means only in America.
Wrong.
Okay.
Whatever, dude. One of the people commenting at the moment is sitting on another continent on a bus.
That was a joke.
I'm in
that
Canada.
Was a joke, everybody.
You Americans are so American-centric.
It was a joke.
And armed. So armed. Earl,
and
you American Yankee?
I don't see how I'm going to avoid it. Someone at
I'm
my
in
door.
Portland. We're
right back.
On the world. Bye,
okay,
David. You chased him out, Carrington. Good job.
And thank gosh we finally got rid of David. Air smells cleaner. The sun is brighter. Oh, David's back.
We mean, hey, we're glad to have you back, David.
Is that what we mean?
Earl, my son came home, everyone. So.
Oh, good.
Talk to me about this. Epic Case Mod, Earl. Commodore Epic Case Mod. What's this?
Oh, my gosh. So you guys know about the new Commodore computer that's out that you can go buy, mm-hmm. and it's really just a PC-compatible that is in a case that very, very closely resembles a Commodore 64.
Which they did do a nice job, right?
They completely redid
the case. So
they did a beautiful job on those. I don't know how many they've sold. And I don't think that they've released sales numbers, but a couple people have decided I'd like to do something similar, but I don't want to buy one of these. I want to do it myself. So Barry, one of the people who listens to both RetroBits and the Retro Computing Roundtable, is one of the folks who has created something like this. I thought I'd link over to his webpage. He did just a fantastic job.
Really clean
with this. It was very clean. Uses a little mini ATX form factor motherboard that had to meet some fairly exacting specifications so that it would fit within a Commodore 64. He used a device that takes the Commodore 64 keyboard and converts it into the USB signal that you need for a modern PC and actually embedded that within the case.
Wow.
So here you've got what looks like ostensibly a Commodore 64, but it's a modern computing device, even with a solid-state drive. And again, I think the work, if you look at the pictures in this, the work was really cool. So I appreciate getting the email on this, and I thought I'd just share it with the world and say, if you want to build your own Commodore 64-alike modern PC, then you can do it, and at a significant fraction of the cost that you would spend if you were buying one from this outfit. Now, you got to be handy with the tools, and you got to pick the right components and that kind of thing. You don't just get it prepackaged. But isn't this some nice work? What do you guys think?
Mm-hmm. He also customized a BIOS where it says manufacturer chassis information, manufacturer Commodore version, the 00006510. So that's kind of neat. Little
yeah.
things like that.
Just very cool.
I noticed his Commodore 64 is made in England, so he must be in England, I guess.
I think so.
Maybe, yeah. So, you know, it's very nice. I mean, it's just, and it's so small, that board in there.
Well, I don't know if England, but I think Europe.
Okay. Yeah, just the case, the original Commodore case was made.
It seems like in the email that he sent me, he quoted what this cost him in euros, I think. So, somewhere over there across the pond.
Over there. Somewhere over there.
It's got like a...
to the west of me.
It's got a DN2 2800 MT processor. So I guess it's kind of... Okay. Oh, I'm trying
to find... It's an Atom, right?
No, it's an Intel Citrino 1030. I don't know. I don't know what it is. I'm trying to figure it out. Oh, I guess I can link off to it. Let's see what it says.
Yeah.
Do it.
Intel.com. It's a mini ITX desktop and the Intel NM10 Express chipset. Oh, the Atom processor N2800. Okay. That's what that means. Cool. It's a very low power. It'll probably stay nice and cool in there, no problem. I like it.
Yes, and I'm all for this sort of thing, provided someone starts with a gutted, non-functional computer. Because the last thing you'd want to do is take even a Commodore 64, even one of those. The last thing you'd want to do is
hey
destroy
now,
a perfect working one.
I sense some disparagement going on here. What the?
Well, I had to say working in quotes.
Hey working.
Now. We don't destroy good hardware.
That's but we right. will destroy Commodore 64s.
Earl, will you have him send us a review? A review one, please. Have
him sure. Absolutely.
A review.
A demo unit.
Yeah. Yep. Review. We'll review it on this show. No problem.
Yep.
It's not going to happen. Who's up next? Oh, it's me. Look at me. Crippled by nostalgia. So Crippled by Nostalgia, the fraud of
retro
gaming. I knew
there was something wrong with you.
Yes, so this is an article on Eurogamer.net. And the weird thing was, in reading this, I had this crazy sense of deja vu. I swore I had read this article before. In fact, I thought we talked about this article on this show. I went and looked at our show history, and then I went and searched the net for this article. Going, this can't have just been published a few days ago. I know this article. I even copied bits of the text and pasted it in Google to try to find who this guy plagiarized it from. But I guess it was just my brain going bonkers.
So. It does seem familiar, maybe. Like, I haven't read it.
Familiar.
But, it seemed like
but yeah, so this is an article about the idea... Even saying this, I swear we talked about this, that this was, but it's published just 3 days ago, but, oh,
you,
God.
You're having a deja vu.
But I'm having a deja vu again every time I talk about this. So anyway, I swear we've talked about this. Maybe somebody in the comments will know. But this article says, again, that there's no such thing as liking retro stuff for its own sake, that old games and stuff inevitably aren't as good as you think they are. If you play an old game, if I go and grab, say, this, so Out of This World on, here's my SNES cartridge of Out of This World. If I play this game, I can't actually be liking it. I can't like it for what it is. I can only like it for the memories it evokes of when we liked it before. That things now are necessarily better. Now, the article isn't really saying that is the case.
I don't agree with that.
Yeah, the article is just looking into that idea, and it sort of concludes in a wishy-washy way that games that we enjoyed as a part of why we like them is the nostalgia factor, and that will make us like games more, but it doesn't necessarily mean that all old things are bad. So it takes a wishy-washy conclusion.
I'm up for it being a factor, but obviously when my kids love Frogger and Jumpman and all, you know, even Zork and that kind of thing and get into it, in the same way that they do with something on the Wii or whatever, or on the not the Game Boy, but what comes out, the DS? Yeah.
Sure, right.
Or on the iPod.
Those newfangled systems.
Yeah, they like the newfangled stuff. They love it. And they love these old things. I drag out the computers, and they're jumping on them and playing. So they don't have any nostalgia. They weren't even born when these games came out. So I would accept that the nostalgia is a factor. But
would they enjoy it if they weren't interacting with it and through you?
I don't know that they would go seek it out, but I do know that a lot of folks at something like the Retro Gaming Expo are in their late teens, early 20s, that kind of thing. They weren't even born when this stuff came out, and maybe they got interested in it because of their parents, but I think some of them didn't. So I think
there were
this
young
stuff
people, younger, definitely much younger than me people at Kansas Fest.
Yeah, there you go.
It was much younger than me people everywhere.
Yeah, more so every day I get the feeling for myself.
Oh, it's a new record for me today, by the way. Oldest I've ever been.
Very nice.
Yep,
congratulations on that.
I think as well, I do think nostalgia has a real impact, a real force. There's a lot of things that I've been just loving that have been brought back to me as a kid. But I have also been, especially I'm really into games, I have been playing a ton of retro games that I never played as a kid. I didn't play a lot of NES games or SNES games, and I'm playing tons of them now and really enjoying a lot of them. And I have nostalgia in a sense for the console, but not huge nostalgia that way. But I'm still loving the games. I'm hooked on A Boy and His Blob right now. Stuff like that. And also, I think I've mentioned on previous games, I've been playing the games of my friend's childhood. Like, they'll come over and we're playing games together. I'm recording the sessions. I'm not really sure what I'm going to do with them. But like when Sherry came over and we played that Sleuth game, she loved it as a kid. I think it was a real nostalgic kick for her. But I'd never even heard of the game before. It was a PC shareware game. Like, I wasn't a PC gamer. I never even heard of this thing. And I loved playing it with her. And it was a really... Now, a lot of that would be me sharing her nostalgia. But at the same time,
social
it was just a fun
too.
Experience. Yeah, totally. Just sitting down and playing that crappy little shareware game. Really fun afternoon. So I do think a good game is simply a good game. Something like Zork is just as good now as it was in the past, I believe. And there were lots, huge amounts of really crappy games in the past, too. Just like there are huge amounts of...
Yes, indeed.
You know, the Pac-Man for Atari and E.T. for Atari are not... They weren't good games then, and they aren't good games now. But I think the good games then still can hold up. But that's my opinion. I'm a dude who's into this stuff. Anyway, I thought the article was interesting, though I swear we talked about it before.
E.T. has such a bad reputation. I would actually like to see it someday. I've never seen it played.
I've got it. Hideous. Yeah. Unplayably awful. Just crazy. Fall into that little pit, and it's like, what's going on?
Somebody's ringing. Is that you, David? Hello? You guys still there?
It's my phone. It's over in the air, so...
Oh, okay. Carrington, David, are you losing Carrington every now and then? Because
a little bit at first, but he's been okay now.
Doing okay now? Okay.
Uh-oh. And also, Carrington just realized he's not separately recording his audio.
Oh, I wasn't either. But
we'll be okay. We'll be okay. The YouTube...
Been working on YouTube, so...
Yeah.
I want to make a statement. Someone just told me, just like the other day, that... it wasn't Valve, but that someone made a Half-Life mod, the original Half-Life game, which is like 1999, so it's not that old, but it's kind of vintage now, right? 13 years old or whatever. So they used a new engine, and they've redone the whole game. So I was trying to look it up, but that Valve apparently was so impressed by it that they've hosted it so people can download it. I'm trying to find this information out, but so there you go. There's a 13-year-old game, which I was very impressed with, the original Half-Life, that people want to play this old game. It's not real old,
I don't think,
but people are willing to go play it, you know?
Yeah, I don't think it's as much a matter of age. There's an old game by today's standards called Descent 3.
Mm-hmm. And I remember the Descent series, sure.
My son and I love playing Descent 3, and we have a little bit of trouble sometimes due to its age. It'll occasionally crash out on the new hardware. You got to tweak it just right, but we love playing that. Another data point is that the Wii can play GameCube games, and a couple of the favorite games that we have that we actually play on the Wii are, in fact, GameCube games. So it's not about, is it for the latest and greatest? So... Anyway.
Sure, absolutely. And like David, for instance, I've really enjoyed the Aleph 1 project, which was the remake of Marathon. And I played through all the Marathon games, 1, 2, and Infinity.
Yeah, that was like mid-90s.
Using that engine. Sure.
Right, mid to late 90s. And
So I loved them originally. That was like the first game I really played as a LAN game with my friends because we were all Mac guys and just got hooked on Marathon. And then I loved going through those again with the ALF1 project.
I like the name of this article, though. She was crippled by nostalgia.
I felt that way one time when I dropped my pet on my foot. Those Commodore pets are heavy, man. I couldn't walk for a week.
The fraud of retro gaming. I got to really read this.
Yes, you should. Okay, let's move on. Earl,
yes.
Give me a shameless plug. Plug,
let's do it.
Plug that Retro Bits.
You and I and David and lots of other people have talked about this topic. So I decided I'd make a podcast episode on it. And I call it Collection Right Sizing. It is the concept of, wow, I got way too much stuff. And now I got to figure out how am I going to get this collection into what I would call the right size. I point out in the podcast episode that right sizing is kind of a cheeseball term sometimes for like a layoff, but I'm co-opting the term for something positive, which is when you want to take your vintage computer collection and make it something that is less stress for you, more enjoyable for you, where you can actually afford to spend the time and the money on the machines that you have and the ones that are important to you and divest yourself of the other things in your collection that you're never getting to or spending enough time with. I know you've been working on this, David, and so what I've tried to do in this podcast is encapsulate the different concepts that have to do with how do you accomplish this? How do you pick the machines that you're going to keep versus the ones that you're not, versus the ones that you're just going to sit on for a while? What are the criteria? What methods are you going to use when you decide which machines you're going to keep and which ones you're going to not? You know, how you're going to store them, how you're going to sell them, that kind of thing. So shameless plug for an upcoming Retrobits that I anticipate actually airing in this next few days. So I thought I'd kick it out there and also just kick it to us for discussion because I know, Carrington, you've mentioned before you keep a rather Spartan collection just due to size, but also it's less stress to know that you've got the machines that you like and you can work with the machines.
Yeah,
that you
hardware
like, right?
wise, I have very little. I've got an Apple. I've got two GSs and two Apple IIes. One that's like a use computer, and one that's the parts computer that I can dip into because these things die. And I think that's it for my heavy use retro things. Like I'm so geared towards Apple II use that those are really just the ones. And I have a 2C that came into my hands, then I gave it away to someone else. And I don't really collect software that much. I'm really not much of a collector. I just like to play it. I have a much larger than typical Apple II box software collection at the moment, but that's just because I'm so far behind on 1 megahertz episodes, and that's really the way I've been giving them away. Like, I play it, and then I'm done with it, and it's just I want to pass it on to somebody else who might enjoy it to either keep it or play it or do whatever. I'm just not the sort of guy who wants to hang on.
And not to give away too much about the episode, but one of the things you just mentioned is really important, which is spares. That the computers that you do decide that you want to keep and make the centerpieces of your collection, these things are going to break, and it's expensive when you have to go out and replace them, increasingly so. So having spares is a good idea. How many spares you have or what's actually within your collection already is one of the good parameters for when you're deciding what to keep and what not. So anyway, so I'd throw that out, and if people have comments about that and you want me to talk about any of your comments in this upcoming Retrobits, then shoot us some email either at feedback@rcrpodcast.com or earl@retrobits.com. Either one works.
Now, Lizard Boy is almost to work, and it's heavily raining, and the roads are flooding.
Ooh.
He's listening to the show.
He listens on
That's
the bus.
Good.
Yeah. Hang in there.
It's awesome.
Yeah. We're sending out good vibes your way.
I'm not. Screw you.
Carrington.
Don't say that.
Okay, so let's go. We got one more piece of news, and it's from
what
me.
Is it?
And it's not a plug. It's a game I recently purchased called Cypher, the Cyberpunk Text Adventure. And it's really interesting that in 2012, somebody has put out, a couple of brothers, have put out a new text adventure with feelies. Everything's digital, though, so all the feelies you get are in the form of digital files that you download. That, then there's photographs and menus and maps and hint, there's a hint book that comes with it and all that kind of stuff. So it's just interesting that, well, the text adventure has been alive and well for a while in the indie way. Lots of people make little games and release them for the various text adventure contests and that kind of stuff. It's neat to see a very professionally done, feely-filled text adventure get released in 2000. Like, right now there's a sale on, I think it's like $20 or $25 for the biggest kit you can get, and like $15 for just the basic game, and then there's a middle kit as well. And I have yet to play it, but I was really interested in it. I liked the trailer. It got me hooked on the game. It's a relatively low price point. I mean, high compared to like Apple II, or compared to like iPad games or something. But compared to Box software, it's relatively cheap. And it looks really interesting, and I love text adventures, so I'm keen to try this one. And since there's a sale on right now, I thought I'd bring it to everyone's attention. So it's something you can check out and see if you're interested. You can save yourself some bucks if you buy it now versus a month from now.
Nice.
I wish they could pull off, you know, making a physical version.
Well, yeah, I mean, it seems like they're really just pushing, I think, to try to keep costs down and not have to mail stuff all over the world. So I can see that is approach. I've sort of just unpacked it. It works for both Mac and Windows. So there's two different, when you buy it, you get links to both them. And then there's like another package you get to download all your bonus copies, all the feelies. So the feelies
aren't art and the production value is just outstanding.
It does. It looks really, really good. Now, and I read a few reviews of the game, all of which give it like 4 out of 5 stars, that kind of stuff. So the people that have been playing the game, the reviewers seem to really like it. So I feel confident promoting it, even though it's a game I haven't played. So by the next show, I'll know a little bit more about it. But I wanted to bring it up because the sale's on right now.
Does it seem to you guys like the vintage, both the software and the accessory market, is actually expanding? I mean, there's just more stuff all the time for vintage folks interested in vintage computing.
It seems, I think, is just in dribs and drabs it gets released and it sort of stays around, so there just keeps being new things. I'm quite happy about it. So anyway, that was it. Just want to bring that up.
The most amazing thing about Digital's new 486 75 megahertz computer isn't that it can fit in your briefcase. It's that it fits, full-size screen, keyboard and all, in the envelopes in your briefcase. Introducing the Digital High Note Ultra. About 4 pounds light and 1 inch thin. The functionality of a notebook. The portability of, actually, an envelope.
Following line to your autoexec.bat file.
Chapter 4, Troubleshooting.
You told me you can do this.
Would you help me on this, please?
I'm trying.
What?
File not found.
You lost the presentation?
So if you want to just call the support line, try it again, please.
You sure you guys know what you're doing?
If you want a computer that's easy to use, there's still only one way to go.
So, speaking of things to purchase, let's jump into the retro computing gift idea the section. And of course, it's the section. It's my time to recommend a gift because I'm playing host. And the host gift I have selected is from Zazzle. It's an adventure shirt. What I like about this shirt is basically the adventures, the dragons or ducks, as they look
yeah,
like,
dragon
from
duck.
The old Atari adventure cartridge. And what I like about this is it's a little less posery than a lot of vintage t-shirts you can get nowadays. You get lots of things that say Player One or that kind of stuff or Zork bits. But this one is subtle in that if you don't know the Atari adventure cart, you won't know what these ducks are. So it's a way to have people walk up to you, and if they say, hey, I love adventure, then you can be friends with them. If they say, what's with the ducks, you know you don't have to have them in your life. So, and so it's on Zazzle.
A litmus test.
Yeah. So it's
you slug them.
A range of different – it's basically just a design. You can get on a range of different shirts. The basic shirt is something like $20 or something like that. So, and then you can get – you know, quarter sleeve ones and girls' cuts and all that. It's basically just a design you can get printed on a shirt. But I dug it. And I'm recommending this one in particular, but, you know, the retro kind of shirts in general. There's a few of them that I like. And so here's one on Zazzle to recommend to everyone.
Kind of pricey, though, huh?
$20 for a shirt? Come on, don't be so cheap. Get
yourself
a shirt.
So
it's
$30
$30 if you get the fancy version with the 3/4 and sleeves and all that kind of stuff.
Oh.
It's $18 for a regular shirt.
Oh, there you go. Value t-shirt.
You always pick you such good stuff spender. for your gift stuff.
I pick stuff that I want people to buy me.
Yeah.
buy me this shirt.
I think I need to make sure I'm on your Christmas list or something.
Yeah,
I want this shirt. Okay, so speaking of buying things, let's look at our eBay auctions from last time. I had recommended Next Step 3.2, the developer kit and operating system, the standalone boxed copies that were available for people to just run on their own 486 or Pentium processor computers. This was Next Step 3.2, not the Next Step 3.3, which was sort of the last big real production version. It's a little more stable. And then I think 4 only came out in beta. Mm-hmm. I believe should have sold because I think they already had bids before, by the time I selected them. So let's see. Yeah, they both did sell. One for £46 and one for, 70. Oh, the developer kit went for £72. That surprises me. Over $100 US. I didn't think it would go for that much. But they both did sell. So there you go. Go Carrington. What about you guys? Earl, what had you selected last time?
I'd picked the PET 4032, the Fat 40, as it's affectionately nicknamed, and it did sell. I'm surprised that it only got one bid. It sold for $150 plus $50 shipping, which isn't bad. The market for PETs seems like it had been going up a little bit. It had even been reaching into the ridiculous there, I think, for a while, but it simmered back down again. So I think this sold for a reasonable price.
I think so, too. And David? I'm surprised I only got one bid, though. But, okay, anyway, David, what did you pick for people to purchase last time?
I picked the Jeff Raskin's Complete Canon Cat System Museum Item in Good Condition Works. It still has not sold. And I guess I'm pretty sure we discussed this, that I thought it was too much. And this particular seller tends to list things at extremely premium prices. So, I mean, it's in great condition and with the printer and everything else, but $13.99, it's just too much.
Mm.
So,
and I've often wondered, I know who you're talking about there on the seller, and I've wondered why they don't at least have the opportunity to make an offer. Because they don't have to take the offers if they don't want to, but...
Got 3,500 items listed. God, this guy makes a living from it.
With the capability of making an offer, at least you could kind of get a feel for what the market will bear. But anyway, it's not my auction, so...
Right.
And can you believe that? 3,550 items. They're not all computers. So I just thought I'd talk about so the vintage computing, 3,350. So I'm trying to get, okay, so actual computers is like 252 currently for this seller. Anyway, okay.
Crazy. So David, what about now? What do you got?
Oh, what do I got now? Oh, okay. I have an original Macintosh 128K system.
And you
I'm
do?
Trying to get Ooh. There. Or I found one on eBay. Which, oh. So this will make... Oh, wait, it's ended. Wow, it's sold since I
nice
picked
choice,
it earlier.
David. Maybe because you picked it.
Oh, you know what? It was buy it now.
Oh.
And so...
somebody pulled the trigger. $1,000.
Somebody bought it.
Yeah, so it was buy it now for $1,000.
Actually, with all the boxes and everything, that was $1,000? I think that was probably listed lower than the... I wonder if they meant to do that or buy it now.
Right, so I think it was, arguably you could say it could have gotten a little bit more, but it was certainly probably worth $1,000 because it's got the mouse box, keyboard, the original Macintosh box.
Oh,
this
could have gone for a lot more than $1,000.
Yeah, the external
disk drive
box. I
wonder if we're acquainted with whoever got it because, David, weren't you having some tweet interactions, some Twitter interactions with some folks who were looking for a 128 to complete their collection?
I don't think so. Not recently. I don't believe so.
No?
David can't always remember stuff.
Might not have been you, but there was definitely a little Twitter chatter going on about that recently in the vintage community.
Yeah, I don't. It wasn't me. I don't think so.
This one to be fully functional, to be demonstrated that it's functional, to have all packaging.
From a brand new seller.
This easily would have sold for over 1,000. I mean, right. Oh, I guess there's a thing.
So. The floppy drive works but doesn't eject properly. That was the only negative, which that's right. Minor.
But still interesting. So. Okay, $1,000.
Mm-hmm. And it's sold. Can't get it.
And it's sold. So already sold. And what about you, Earl? What is your selection for next week? Has it sold already too?
It has not, but it did have an offer already.
Oh, okay.
It's a couple of pieces of vintage computer vintage DOS software, both of which I used back in the day, so it was interesting to me. I love the new old stock sealed stuff. Here's a DBase 3 Plus. I recently picked up a DBase 3 Plus new old stock on eBay and paid, I think, $70 just for the DBase. So the fact that this was a pair of packages for $70 struck me as a good deal.
Has an offer going for $70 is the buy it now, which I don't think is unreasonable at all for these two.
Not at all.
If there really are a new old stock. I mean, that's always the trick with eBay is to see
It is a question. This particular seller does have 100% positive feedback with 1,900 transactions, so seems trustworthy.
It's interesting. I saw we were talking earlier about how there's a whole subculture of people that can sort of tell the difference between the different replica kits for the Apple One and that kind of stuff and the small little details. I was watching watching a video once. I think what the video we talked about or I'd recommended last episode, the 8-bit Game Chaser show. And so I've now watched all those on YouTube. Really, really fun shows. Really, I still highly recommend those. So the link will be in the last show notes. And on that, there was an interesting comment about Nintendo boxes in finding games for the NES sealed and how you can tell an original shrink wrap from a new shrink wrap by looking at like where the seam is and the type of seam and those sorts of little details. And it's funny how people can be aware of like those minute details to tell an original shrink wrap from a new one.
Old shrink wrap gets kind of crispy.
Yeah.
It can, usually. And also the boxes can often, old shrink wrap will often continue to shrink.
Yeah.
So the box will start to get squozen.
Right.
And once you open up one of these things, there's more clues on the inside, whether it's new old stock. For instance, I know at least with Ashton Tate, they would take their discs and their registration card and all that, the serial number card, and they would shrink wrap that on the inside. That came in a sealed package.
Really?
Now, you could, I guess, get a shrink wrap plastic bag and seal that off, but it would be hard. It would be difficult to make it look like the original stuff. The DBase that I got off of eBay was actually brand new. Never had been open, at least the discs.
And did you open it?
So I did. I opened it up.
Did you record the opening? Did you do an unboxing?
No, unfortunately, not on this one. But I can tell you that I smelled that fresh diskette smell. And
I should get that for a car, a floppy disk hanging from the mirror. Get that new software smell.
Right. Give me one of the options at the car wash.
That'd be awesome.
Do you want the new car smell or new disk smell?
Do you have any 8-bit mist?
So you pop open a new box of 10 3M. Yeah.
But it doesn't say what version of WordPerfect
it
is.
Doesn't it look like version 5, though?
That was kind of the biggest selling one, wasn't it? 5.1?
I thought so. But the DBase 3 Plus, I can kind of tell from the look of the box, it's not version 1.1 of DBase 3 Plus. It's the earlier DBase 3 Plus. There were two versions, and this is the earlier of the two.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that funny when you start having, you already put a number in the name, then you start having version numbers.
Yeah.
Okay, so my choice. An odd one that has a bit of nostalgia for me, but I never used this particular model. I picked a Heath HTX 10
Commodore 64.
No, it's not.
I want your pick.
Have either of you guys ever used one of these before?
No.
It's cool.
Weirdly, I used what I think was the exact same thing by a different manufacturer. Around 83, so a billion years ago, I had a Zenith a device that was just like this. I mean, as soon as I looked at it, I thought it was the Zenith. And it's interesting that this has a power supply that says Zenith on it.
Didn't Heath and Zenith do some computing things together?
Yeah. They bought them, right? Zenith bought Heath?
Sitting in a tree? So, yeah. I didn't know that at all. So I used one of these things. So what this is, it's a really neat device. Just a keyboard. It's like an old, like, Tandy keyboard or a little shrunk down Commodore, I guess. And built into the keyboard is a terminal. So it has a monitor output, so you can connect a monitor to it. It's got, in this case, just a modem plug, like a serial port to plug in a modem. The one I had, I think, had a modem built in it, if I recall. It's a lot of years ago, though. And this also has a parallel port, so you can dump to a printer. So the one that I use just has an actual terminal, so it's not a terminal And I also would sometimes just use it as a typewriter. So, because you can just go live and you plug in a printer and you've got a television in front of you, and when you hit return, it's just spitting out characters to the printer. So it makes for an interesting vintage typewriter as well. And if this is the same, and I think it is the same as the Zenith one I had, it has really nice keyboard. There are ELP switches, really nice clacky keyboard, excellent feel to it. So it's going for $200. And I think the one I had, if I remember, was actually called a Zenith ZTX. So I think the model difference, the H just makes it the Heath version or something. So I haven't seen one of these things in forever. I forgot even about this existing. So when I stumbled on the eBay, I knew, okay, well, that'll be my choice. It's 24-day listing for a buy it now. It's just really a store selling it. They're looking for $200. I don't think I'll pull the trigger on it. I don't really have a use for this. And caveat emptor, if I recall, the reason I stopped using it mid-80s was the limitation in the terminal set. It couldn't do VT100. So that'll make it less useful as an actual terminal. Not that there's a lot of places you can dial up to anymore anyway. So, but a neat little device that I haven't seen one of these things in forever.
Just by the way, so Zenith Radio Company bought Heath in 1979, and then they became, then they renamed the computer division the Zenith Data Systems. So,
well, okay.
So,
I've thought about making something like this, taking a Raspberry Pi, getting one of those USB to serial adapters, and finding an ASCII keyboard of some sort that you could plug into this thing, and just making a little, I guess what you'd call the equivalent of a dumb terminal. It would boot up right into the terminal emulator. It would have VT100 or probably Ligersiegler and a couple of other popular emulations. If I had to, I'd program it myself. But I've actually thought about building a little thing like this that would be the modern-day equivalent of a dumb terminal. When I saw this, I was like, man, that looks cool. Nice pick, Carrington.
And honestly, if this did VT100, like I wish I could find a manual for it. If it did, I think I might have even bought it, because I know it's $200 is a lot of money for something I don't know how much use I'd have, but I got that crippled by nostalgia thing going, and it was a great
keyboard.
It was keyboard.
Crippled by nostalgia.
They're small, doesn't take up a lot of space, really unique item. I'm hoping this sells and goes to somebody who's going to keep it in good shape and keep it somewhere. And I have a soft spot in my heart for Heath. A lot of my earliest things were Heath kit stuff. I assembled a lot of things. So
they were always cool stores to go into.
Yeah. Oh, I never went to stores. Mine were all bought like mail order.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's my choice. $200 Heath thing may not be useful at all, but I dig it. So there we go. So let's talk about closing discussion things. What's new with you guys? Anything exciting happening? David, what do you got to share with the group?
Well, I got a couple of let's see. I pull up a document, get the dates right. So the Atlanta Historical Computing Society met yesterday, so we meet once a month. And so that's fun. We're growing, and we're planning the VCF SE. I'm trying to get through this stupid document here. Okay, here it is, a PDF. But so we've got a couple of cool things coming up, and they're kind of prepping us for our Vintage Computer Festival in the Atlanta area. But in a little less than 3 weeks, we will be at the second Mini Maker Fair, which is exciting. And that'll be an exciting all-day, one-day thing, and we'll show off old computers, as well as we're going to highlight a bunch of different retro computing kits. And I worked it out with Jules, the guy who makes the Fignition, to have some of those help himself.
Thanks.
Nice little kit, inexpensive. And then in early November, we'll be doing the Stone Mountain Ham Fest, which is one of the bigger ham fests in the Atlanta area. So it's in the Stone Mountain area.
And interesting, too, that the Hamventions are often good places to bump into vintage computers at reasonable prices if they have a buy-sell-trade kind of table or something like that. I've heard that they can be good venues for that.
In the forums, I commented one time, some people were talking about like where to get old computers, and basically, I said, I don't even try to go to flea markets anymore, or thrift stores usually. You just don't find them there. But estate sales, I think you tend to still find stuff. But Hamfest, you, I think there's a good shot you could find some stuff. But then lastly, so something exciting for me personally is I just went to my first lesson in 3 years.
For violin?
Oh, very cool.
I've always wanted to play the violin. I bought this like years ago. I finally started taking lessons over 3 years ago before I moved to the Atlanta area, and then other all kinds of reasons why I never got back into it. So I found a nice teacher at a good you know, good rate.
I used to play in high school.
Did you really?
I played all through junior high and high school for years and years.
So you'll appreciate. So basically, I only had like 3 months of lessons before.
That's awesome,
so I'm just now
dude.
Getting back
that
to it.
That is totally
yeah,
awesome.
I'm excited about it.
You're going to be a fiddle player.
Yeah. So what's up with you, Carrington?
Oh, me.
Whoever's next. Yeah, you go next. Go ahead, Carrington.
Who's hosted the show?
I knew you'd say that. I was just trying to segue for you.
Gotta control that boy. I have been
sorry.
In the retro stuff. I watched that show that 8-bit Game Chasers show that we were just talking about a few minutes ago that I had mentioned in the last episode of RCR, and it really got me excited about the idea of going back to flea markets and going to places to try to dig up stuff and not just using eBay, which has become my expensive but so easy source for anything retro. Mm-hmm. It's just so simple to just go in there and say, $1 billion shipping to Canada and have it come up here. Because of that show, it got me interested to look up what kind of flea marketplaces and stuff were available in Toronto. And yesterday, I actually did a run around to these 5 big flea markets to see what was available. No vintage computer stuff at all. Although I was able to pick up a monitor. So I needed another monitor from Apple II stuff. So I got an old vintage Magnavox TV/monitor thing. But I was able to pick up some NES and SNES games and grab those relatively cheap. And yesterday as well, because I was on the kick of doing that, I looked on Craigslist to see and just searched for Apple II and that kind of stuff, which I hadn't done in ages. And coincidentally, today and yesterday, there was a yard sale, or garage sale as we call them up here, for somebody who was listing. They had Apple II stuff for sale. So I thought, oh, well, I'll swing by there and see what he's got. And so for $5, I was able to pick up a large shopping bag full of cards of miscellaneous type that go inside. I don't even know what the heck they are.
Wow.
Two half-height floppy disks. An Apple II clone that the guy had made himself. He used to get boards and solder them together, and he'd buy off the shelf from China like Apple II knockoff cases. And he had two of them, and I bought one of them and left one for somebody else to find. And two large, you know, this big, or if you're looking at it, twice the size of my head, collections of just miscellaneous floppy disks, mostly pirated stuff, and just like who knows what's on there. So for $5, it was like such a steal. I'm just so pleased so that I went to that, and then I went and bought a bunch of cards and things or a bunch of carts for old vintage games. And also, I tweeted about this, but through the week, I dropped by a surplus place here in Toronto. There's a few of them, and I dropped by Active Surplus, and I hadn't realized they have more than one location. I've always just known the downtown location. It turns out they have one up in North York that's not too far from a place I was working from it. So I went in there, and I bought some boxes of floppy disks. David was wondering about floppy disks. Yes, here in Toronto, we can still buy 5 1/4-inch floppy disks. So
they're not high density.
They are both double-sided, double-density ones. So,
very cool.
Yeah, so I got one box of Gold Star, one box of TDK. I think there were something like $2.50 a box for a box of 10. And the big purchase, though, when I go looking around the same place, I don't even like this stuff, but I'll find a way on OneMakers to give it away. I got this, the big box version of Star Raiders for Atari 400 and 800. Still sealed.
Nice box.
And yeah, still sealed in the original shrink, like the big box Atari ones, for $1. So, I mean, just...
That is a steal.
Active Surplus is an awesome place to drop in. And I tweeted about it in that same store. So if you're in Toronto and you're into Amiga stuff, they have 3 different Amigas still in the box in that store, going for like $20 a piece or something like that. So if you're interested in Amigas, they had an Amiga 500 and 2 other Amigas. I really don't know the Amigas, but in their boxes for you know, $15, $20 each. So if you're in Toronto and you're looking for an Amiga, there's... go up to the North York Active Surplus, and you should be able to pick one up in the box.
Now, something like those Amigas, it's not worth it to them, you think, to sell them on eBay? Because they know they could get more for them.
I guess they could. They're just
I would think so.
Stores. I don't know.
They get way more.
Yeah, I've always loved Active Surplus, and also Above All Surplus here in Toronto, the 2 surplus places. And Active has been around since I was a kid. Like, they've been around forever. So I was delighted to find out they have more than one location, and delighted to find out I can still drop in and get shrink-wrapped floppy disks. So
for good score on that Star Raiders, too. That's got to be one of my favorite games for the 400-800. Have you ever played it?
I have not. I played reading the instructions or reading the box and then looking at some video about the gameplay online. I think I played a knockoff of this game for Intellivision. There was an Intellivoice game. Remember the Intellivoice, mm-hmm. the little plug-in module that would give some speech? There was only like 8 games or something like that for Intellivoice, very few. One of them, I swear, was Star Raiders, but it wasn't called Star Raiders. So maybe somebody in the forums will know, but I think this game got knocked off and became an Intellivoice game for Intellivision, and I think that's what I played.
Huh.
So there. So anyway, I'm going to be giving it away. So I'll find a way. Maybe we can do a contest or something here because I'm not an Atari guy. So I will resist opening this up, even though you guys know how I love to unshrink wrap things. And I'm sure there's somebody out there who, one of our listeners, who likes Atari stuff. So we'll off camera, let's muse on a way that we can get this into somebody's hands who will appreciate it. I will contribute the $1 item to a giveaway.
Very nice.
Yeah.
I'm trying to find anything.
What have you been up
surplus.
To?
Well, I've actually got ahead of me here a couple of what I'd call restoration projects, and one of them I'm absolutely completely unqualified for, but I still think I'm going to try and go at it. I've got a DEC VT240 graphics terminal that doesn't work right now. You get the video signal coming out of it, but there's no text, no characters, so something's broken on the inside of it, and it may take component-level repair, for which, like I say, I'm woefully unqualified, but I'm thinking I've got it. It didn't cost me anything to get the unit, and so I want to fix it. So cool. I'll be hopefully working with some kind folks on the Vintage Computer forums to see if they can guide me, Mr. Newbie, through this process of restoration.
Are you willing to work with unkind folks who will help you and yet make fun of you?
Absolutely.
Then I'm raising my hand.
Yeah. Very nice. The other thing that I've got a couple of S100 chassis, and these are gigantic sheet metal boxes with linear power supplies and S100 card slots and that kind of thing. And as far as I know, they work. I've never actually powered them on because I understood the linear power supplies have these gigantic capacitors that kind of dry out over time, and I'd like to make sure that I refurbish them as carefully as I can, but I'm going to take the components out of them, clean them all up real nice. They're actually in really, really good shape, and they're the extra tall S100 chassis, so they could take the big boards. And this is going to be quite an effort, but there was a conversation on the Vintage Computer forums recently. Somebody was trying to get a project going to create new chassis and new motherboards for the S100 stuff, because as you guys might know, if you pay attention to the S100 computer site or some of the chatter on the classic computer mailing list, there's lots of new S100 boards that are being created today.
Really?
With Andrew Lynch and the group of people who work with him. You can buy these printed circuit boards, and they have a bill of materials. You go out and buy the components, and you put them together, and you've got brand new S100 stuff. But the problem is the chassis. Once you create the boards, what do you put them in? There's no standard way to go create a new S100 sort of a card cage or power supply or that sort of thing. So they're looking at what do they do to host these cards. And I was thinking, well, for me, if I ever decide to do this, I've got a couple of these S100 chassis that are in good condition, and I just need to light them up. So that's one of the projects I'll be working on hopefully over the next few weeks. That's it for me.
Well, very cool. Well, excellent. That was fun, guys. I think we're going to wrap up the show a bit. Remember, if you are watching live, to stay tuned, because we'll have maybe have a bit of show and tell. I've got something else really cool to show you guys, which we'll save for off camera or off mic. In the meantime, though, thanks very much for listening to the show and watching if you join us live on YouTube. Help spread the word through tweeting and through forums and stuff if you can, and maybe throw a review down on iTunes. The most important thing, though, is that you listen. We really, really appreciate it. You can send us feedback by emailing feedback@rcrpodcast.com or sending us a direct message on Twitter. On Twitter, we're @rcrpodcast. You can follow that for show notes and links and that kind of stuff. And if you head over to rcrpodcast.com, our site, you'll find links to the forum that we use. And so always lots of great discussions and stuff going on there. In the meantime, again, thanks for listening. It's been from all three of us at RCR Podcast. Retro Review.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
later.